Hello and welcome to part two of the Hear This module on drugs in lactation. In part two, I continue my discussion with Treasure, focusing on the impact of medicines in breast milk. So, if the mum does continue to breastfeed, at some stage it's possible that she's going to have to take medicines herself. And this is really where pharmacists can add another layer of support, as they're bound to be called upon to advise about the safety of the medicine for the baby and also the impact of the medicine on milk production. It's got to be important then for pharmacists to have an understanding of how medicines do cross into the milk and then exactly how they pass into the baby. Could you just describe that process for us briefly?
Okay, so it's back to basic pharmacokinetics. The tablet is taken by mum. We'll start off with an immediate release dose form of a tablet or a capsule. We'll leave control release dose forms aside for the moment. So you take your dose within an hour, depending upon, you know, its dissolution rate, but on average an hour, it's starting to peak in the plasma, been absorbed through the small intestine into the plasma, and depending upon the ratio of fat to water of the drug, how lipophilic or hydrophilic it is, it's going to like to sit in the plasma, or it's going to prefer to distribute into a more lipophilic medium like into the breast milk. But the passage from plasma to breast milk is across a single membrane, and it's very rapid. So essentially within an hour of the dose, the drug is in the milk. If it's a really long half-life drug, it might take a little bit longer, but I'm just going with generalities here. So once it's peaked in the plasma, it's essentially peaked in the milk. And the problem with the main measure that you find in textbooks or in the product information, which is milk plasma ratio, that's when that ratio is measured. Because what they're looking at is, at a maximum, what proportion of the drug is getting across into the breast milk. But in reality, that's a poor measure, because from the moment it's peaked, it starts to partition back into mum across same plasma membrane, because mum's liver and kidneys are chomping up the drug. And so the volume of distribution gets progressively smaller, which makes, in terms of balance, the drug want to pass back into mum's plasma. So really, we should be looking at the relative infant dose. So that's over the life of the dose, what proportional percentage of the drug is available for baby to be exposed to. Remembering that baby weighs, I'm just going to say, 3 kilos versus mum's 60-something kilos. So you have to, that's why it's relative infant dose. You're working it out proportionately for the baby's weight versus the mum. And the American Academy of Pediatrics uses the term, and it's quite deliberate, the drug is compatible. They never use the term safe, because that's a whole different story. Yeah. It's compatibility with breastfeeding. And their definition is a percentage of 10% or less of the drug equates to the relative infant dose. Okay, so if the baby's exposed to 10% or less of the dose based on their weight compared with mum's weight, that's compatible with breastfeeding. And the only exceptions are half a dozen drugs that have a very low therapeutic index. So we're talking the warfarins, the digoxins, etc.
Okay.
But for 99% of drugs, that's the definition. And if you look at the literature, there are very few drugs that are then not compatible with breastfeeding.
Okay.
And I think that's the message we don't get across. You can say two things, that whatever's in the breast milk will always be less than what baby was exposed to during the pregnancy, particularly in the second half of the pregnancy where drugs accumulate in the fetus. And often in the early postpartum period, we actively desire baby to be exposed to a touch of the drug. So this is not talking about breastfeeding per se, but you've got to understand the physiology of pregnancy. That once we move beyond first trimester and the issue of congenital anomalies, with drug exposure, second trimester, the main effects of drugs are on growth and development. So smoking, for example, is much more of an issue than many drugs because of the vasoconstriction and less nutrient getting across to baby and into uterine growth retardation. But in third trimester, basically the fetus has to take on more and more of the role of their own nutrient, and by, you can add drugs into that category, nutrient and drug absorption and subsequent elimination. And so they are less efficient at it than the mum.
Yeah.
Because they've got immature microsomal enzymes, yes, etc. So mum is taking her daily dose, but baby's got maybe up to five times the half-life in baby as in mum. So we get this gradual accumulation of the dose in the fetus compared with the mother. And when we cut the umbilical cord, if mum has been on a drug regularly, so I'm thinking, you know, gestational diabetes, pregnancy-induced hypertension, asthma, epilepsy, whatever. Baby's full of whatever mum was taking. We cut the umbilical cord and that will start to gradually dissipate. So if the drug is CNS active, you'll see the manifestation of that withdrawal of the drug from baby, with baby being irritable, not able to sleep, not able to settle. So all of our mums on psychoactive drugs, you know, antidepressants, anti-anxiety agents, antipsychotics, drugs for bipolar depression, we actually want to smooth out that elimination, and by having a small amount in the milk can offset those withdrawal effects in baby. And that can be really important. So there's very few scenarios where we wouldn't actively encourage mum to breastfeed on her drug therapy in that first 2 week window. And then we can talk about whether the drug needs to be there long term in baby or not.
So obviously, if it, as you were saying, if it's a therapy that she's already been on, then there's no disadvantages. There's actually advantages in breastfeeding while she's continuing on that. But
that's right, particularly in that early postpartum period.
But for a new medication that she might not have taken during the pregnancy.
So like for postpartum depression.
Exactly, yeah.
Then we look at choosing an antidepressant with the pharmacokinetic profile that would minimise excretion into breast milk. So we might pick a sertraline over a fluoxetine, which has got a shorter half-life. But we wouldn't pick paroxetine, because paroxetine's got some stimulant effects, and if mum goes on and off the drug, you actually see withdrawal effects more with paroxetine than some of the other SSRIs. Now, that's not saying we need to fiddle with the dosing regimen in any way, or the breastfeeding regimen, because for 85% of mums, for example, I'll pick sertraline again, there's less than 2% of relative infant dose that gets across into the milk.
Okay.
So for most infants, it's just not going to be an issue at all.
Mm-hmm.
But you often have mums feeling, whether it's the guilt, that sense of responsibility for the as primary custodian of that infant, that they want to do something to minimise exposure.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's an immediate release dose form, not a controlled release dose form, because with a controlled release we don't have a peak and a trough.
Yeah.
But with your immediate release products, you can feed away from the peak. And remember I said for most drugs within an hour it's starting to peak in the milk. So, and we feed about a newborn, you know, 3 to 4 hourly. And often the drug is taken once a day or no more than twice a day. But if you could pick a drug that's once daily, you basically give baby a good feed before that dose, avoid feeding for 2 to 4 hours after the dose and feed normally for the rest of the day.
Okay.
And by doing that, you could drop what the relative infant dose by about 50%. You may not need to, but often mums feel really in better control when everything else is going out of control, if they can do something that they feel contributes to baby's well-being. And so sometimes we'll recommend that strategy, not because we really need to, but they need something.
They're being part of the therapy.
Yeah.
So you were talking before about, obviously we need to know as pharmacists mm-hmm. the kinetics of the drug to do some prediction of what exactly. it's going to do in terms of partitioning into breast milk. But then obviously it has to then go into the gut of the baby and then be absorbed by them. So that's another process of elimination, that they're reducing the dose that they're receiving.
And a really simple way of thinking about that aspect, one example that I always use with my students, whether they're medical or pharmacy, is gentamicin.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and again, I work in a hospital setting, but we use a lot of gentamicin in postpartum mums, and we'll say, you know, this is a drug we're giving by injection, so you're going to have 100% bioavailability. What they forget is, why do we give gentamicin by injection? Because its bioavailability orally is just about zero.
That's right, yeah.
So it doesn't matter how much is in mum's bloodstream and gets into the milk.
Yeah.
When baby comes to drink that milk, basically very little absorbed. So what are you going to see? You're going to see some impact on the gut, because it's all going through baby's gut and not being absorbed.
Mm-hmm.
So there could be a little bit more diarrhea or loose bowel motions, but in terms of an impact systemically on baby, not at all.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're worried about what baby's actually going to receive, just go and look up the oral bioavailability of the medicine, and that can short-circuit the process. But remember, there still probably is some gut effects.
So we need to know a little bit about the drug in terms of its kinetics to look at partitioning into breast milk, and then also about what its oral bioavailability is to see how it's going to be absorbed in the infant.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a few different steps there. So you were talking before about advising the mum to breastfeed prior to her dose, and I think that that's probably standard advice that pharmacists get. But it's not going to really cut it in every situation. Say, for example, you've got a brand new baby and you're feeding every couple of hours.
Yeah.
Or, as you mentioned, if you're taking a sustained-release form of the drug or a very long half-life drug, then that's not really going to be able to be an approach to reducing it.
Exactly, which is why you've got to have that conversation about the relative infant dose. And there's a couple of places that pharmacists can go to. There is the American Academy of Pediatrics. If you Google, there'll be 2 or 3 publications. I think the last one was in 2013 that talks about general principles of drugs and breastfeeding and how to minimise exposure. So it's a nice global article, about 14 pages long. There's a textbook by Thomas Hale, and you know, if you've got this kind of clientele, I think it's well worth spending $100 or so to get a handbook that goes through A to Z most of the drugs that you're going to come in contact with, and it will work through the key PK parameters, calculate based on any case reports where they've measured plasma versus breast milk concentrations to work out the relative infant dose for you. And you can see at a glance, if it's less than 10%, it's going to be fine. And he categorises drugs into L1, L2, L3, with L1 being the safest. Do what you like anytime. L2... generally fine. L3, sometimes we have to manipulate a little to minimise mm-hmm. exposure.
So that approach that we talked about before, about doing the feed prior to the dose. Mm-hmm. The other thing that we'll quite often say to them, mum, then is to potentially, if possible, to express the next feed prior to taking the dose as well. Is that, would that work out as being advantageous?
Not prior to taking the dose, because if it depends on the number of doses in the day.
Yeah.
And what is feasible and realistic for someone to do and how necessary is it. So my order of thinking about that is, first of all, in reality, do I need to minimise exposure? So does it have a relative infant dose of 10% or less, and as long as it's not a big, low therapeutic index drug, and if it's got an RID of 10% or less, I know in my mind we don't need to manipulate the feeds at all. And it's only from a psychosocial perspective that we might choose to do so. Secondly, I look at mum's frame of mind and her, because it is a shared decision, what her goals and aspirations in relation to the medicine is. So if I feel that adherence is a real issue, and this is a drug that mum genuinely needs, that's going to push me into thinking about some alternative strategies. The next thing I think about is for that indication and the drug that's been prescribed, how often in the day has it been prescribed? If it's four times in the day, there is nothing I can do with manipulating the feed that's going to get around that very easily. And so we look at the RID and make some hard decisions based on that. If it's, if we can get it to twice a day or once a day, preferably once a day with an immediate release dose form, then the only time you may ever need to express and discard is the very first peak after the dose. So that's the milk aliquot within the 4 hours of the dose.
Yeah.
Not before the next dose.
Mm-hmm.
And if you express and discard that first milk aliquot, you've captured the peak. You want to do it at the time of the peak, ideally.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can actually drop the volume of distribution of that drug by about 50%. That means every other feed after that will have 50% less than it would have. So that can be a beneficial strategy where you've got a high-risk drug, a high RID drug, and a real need for mum to be adherent.
Okay, so talking about those high-risk drugs, those that have a relative infant dose of greater than 10%, what are we... You mentioned before there aren't very many of them, which might surprise us.
Yeah.
What are we looking at, really?
Funnily enough, many of the complementary medicines that are herbal, not all CAMs, but the lipophilic herbs, the key active constituents of most herbs are very lipophilic.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something to bear in mind. Drugs that have a high CNS penetration also tend to be lipophilic. Drugs that have a very small molecular weight, like lithium and bipolar depression, may be problematic. If they're CNS active, we're looking at that with a long half-life. And I'm sort of running out.
So they really, really aren't very many.
So we, and people go, oh my goodness, monoclonal antibodies, worry, worry, worry. Mm. Yet they're huge molecules.
Yeah.
You know, they're just not going to get across into the breast milk. I probably wouldn't be recommending cytotoxics routinely. Having said that, sometimes with particular cancers, they're diagnosed during the pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
And we wait for baby to be born to start chemotherapy. And we will try and work around so the baby can actually, mum can breastfeed baby even in that circumstance. Sometimes transplant drugs used in a immunosuppressive sense, mums worry about, but I work with Prince Charles Hospital and their transplant team, and again, we've produced evidence to show that most of those drugs can be worked around. So bottom line, if you're keen and really dedicated to breastfeeding, we can work around 95% of the issues, long as you've got a sufficient nutrient supply in the milk to be able to make it worthwhile for baby.
So if we look at some of those specific examples, like the lithium, or as you mentioned, the more lipid-soluble psychiatric medicines, what sort of adverse reactions in the baby would a pharmacist be telling the mum about to look out for?
You'd be looking at, well, two things. I think there's always potentially effects on the gut.
Yeah.
Because what there won't be 100% bioavailability from an oral dose form, or mostly there won't be. So, and baby is as yet not as practiced as being in the real world, so their gut is always that little bit more vulnerable. So we're going to see changes in bowel motion. Mum on an antibiotic would be a classic example of that.
Yeah.
Some antibiotics, now Flagyl, metronidazole, is not particularly dangerous in breastfeeding. It doesn't have a high RID. But have you ever had Flagyl?
Yeah, it tastes awful.
Baby is not immune
yeah.
to that fact. And particularly if they're an older baby, you know, a couple of months old, that used to chocolate milkshake in a breast.
Yeah.
And suddenly give them dead fish, breast milk. They know the difference.
Yeah.
And so sometimes babies will refuse a feed because the milk tastes bitter.
Okay.
That's not saying there's anything bad or nasty about it.
Mm.
It's just they're very sensitive to that. And mum can misinterpret that as, oh, the milk must be terrible or dangerous because baby's not accepting it. So I guess be aware of the bitterness of some of the medications that we use, and that might just have a superficial effect on baby. Beware the gut. And the rest is, what does the side effect profile of the drug tell me? And if it says it causes nausea or constipation, then if baby gets enough through the milk, then they'll probably have some residual of those effects. So, you know, go to the product information and use it judiciously. But remember, there'll be a fraction, less than 10%, in the milk in terms of relative infant dose for 80% of the drugs out there.
And it sounds like we can't always rely on the recommendation in lactation in the PI or the CMI, for example, because quite often it will say, don't know, because the studies haven't been done in human lactating.
We did a research project on a repository of 125,000 calls from consumers, and within that cohort there was more than, I think, 20 or 30,000 that related to medication in children, of which a big proportion of those were children less than 12 months of age.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest question from consumers related in that cohort of less than a year of age to breastfeeding or drugs in lactation. And within that question group, we looked at what were the commonest drugs. And then we compared the CMI, not only for the individual drug, but across different brands of the same medication. And there is huge variability across the brands and recommendations. And it's simply because the product information is not a medical document.
Yeah.
Was never intended to be. And we've got to stop thinking of it like that. It is a document written by the manufacturer of that product. They own it. And it is a medico-legal document. So they have every right. And the TGA doesn't require uniformity of information, the PI. They require uniformity of approach and phrasing in the CMI, but in the product information, it's for the company to decide based on risk what they will say. And for example, one thing that jumped out at me when we did this review, paracetamol and codeine. Panadeine, Prodeine, whatever. If I go to Thomas Hale or the American Academy of Pediatrics or the WHO lactation listings, paracetamol will have a recommendation separate to codeine.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Codeine of the two will be the slightly higher risk as an opioid.
Yeah.
More lipophilic, more, you know, penetration into milk, etc. When I go to the product information, it's a combined product. It's a single risk. So they assign the risk to the drug that they consider the highest rather than look at each drug separately.
Sure.
So they have the right to say incompatible, contraindicated, don't use in children under 6 years of age. That's what their indication is for. And that sends the wrong message. So you need to go beyond the product information to a recognised and quality resource if this is the area you're interested in. And as I said, there's a good half a dozen resources that we can use. But unfortunately, not all of them are free. And I guess you've got to make that judgment call about whether you're willing to purchase a text or an online resource if you get enough of these questions.
So what would you say then to potentially maybe a pharmacist who isn't receiving very many inquiries about medicines in lactation or is feeling a little bit that their knowledge isn't quite good enough to directly answer questions? What would your advice be to them?
Right, well, before 2010, we did have a national drug information service, the TACE, that was open to community-based health professionals, and that's where I would have referred a primary health carer to. Because the government and have deemed that primary health carers don't need that secondary resource, we're basically on our own.
Okay.
And I think people need to take that on board. And like every other aspect of our duty of care, we need to upskill, you know, or say, I don't know, and refer the person to someone that does. And there are a number of resources that will be kind and help you,
right?
if you initiate that response. So first of all, use the manufacturer. Their product information may say contraindicated or use with caution. Ring them up on their 1300 or 1800 number and say, I have a particular scenario. Provide the evidence for me that supports your recommendation. And often they will then say, well, in fact, there are some case reports and this was the relative infant dose and there were no problems. But they can't recommend that formally, but they can provide you the case reports that give you similar information. A simple PubMed search with the drug that you're after and the term lactation or breastfeeding in a PubMed search will often retrieve very quickly the case reports. If you're lucky enough to be a health professional, live in New South Wales, they have the MotherSafe source, but it's only funded for practitioners in New South Wales.
Right.
So if you've got an association with your local obstetric hospital, or you ring the hospital pharmacy department of that obstetric hospital, and long as you do it judiciously, you know, once or twice a year when you're really stuck, they will probably help you and be happy to do so. If you were doing it every week, they don't have the resources to be able to support you. So it's about, you know, being judicious in your information seeking. But that's why going back to first principles, you can get the compatibility, you can get the milk plasma ratio. Does it have a high plasma protein binding? That's in the PI. If it's 95% PPB, there's only 5% at any moment in time that's available. If it's got a bioavailability of 5% or less, it's probably not going to be an issue. So you can use other blood and gut sort of measures to get a guesstimate.
Go back to first principles.
Yeah. That's what pharmacists were trained to do. And we should use those skills because we're much better at it than our medical colleagues, let me tell you.
And I think what you're saying is that equally we have a responsibility to help reduce the risk of the medicine that the mum is taking, but in the same vein also not to overly concern them by simply looking at the product information and saying, well, the manufacturer says you can't have it.
Women, so I get or used to get the aftermath of asked about, you know, what does the health professional do? But we ran the National Consumer Medicines Information Service for initially 8 years in Queensland and then another nearly 9 years Australia-wide. And repeatedly with those thousands of questions from anxious caregivers about the safety of a drug in breastfeeding, we would look for what motivated the caller to pick up the phone today, not last week or the week before, but, you know, so we would ask him, so what made you phone today? And conflicting information, inadequate information, too much information. They've done that Google searching and the PubMeding, and they've downloaded all this data, but they don't know what it means. They can't interpret it. All of this uncertainty drives help-seeking behaviour. So one of two things, if we want to avoid that cycle, when we have that script, and it's pretty obvious if someone's been coming to see you from time to time and you've seen them go through a pregnancy and they now walk in with a newborn infant, they're probably breastfeeding. So you need, and you know the medicines then if they're a regular customer, talk to them proactively. Don't wait for them to get so anxious, so uncertain, that they're in a real state and it makes it much difficult for you to reassure. Because what they're seeking is reduction of their uncertainty and reassurance. And we have a huge role to play in that.
Okay, well, thanks, Treasure, for chatting about drugs and lactation with us today. I think you've helped address the common questions that pharmacists are regularly asked and cleared up some of those grey areas for us.
No worries. Thanks a lot.
For the purposes of pharmacist CPD credits, by listening to parts 1 and 2 of this module, you can claim one Group 1 credit. For those pharmacists who are members of the college and would like to undergo an assessment to be eligible for Group 2 credits, proceed to the college website www.acp.edu.au and enrol in the activity called Hear This, AJP Audio, Drugs in Lactation. I'm Dr. Brett McFarlane, Education and Research Manager for the Australian College of Pharmacy, and thank you for listening.